Prius and Avalon. Yesterday, Toyota announced the recall of 110,000 Tundra pickups, model years 2000 through 2003. The problem with those is excessive rust on the frame. Dave Mattingly, NPR News, Washington.
The space shuttle Atlantis has begun its trip home. The shuttle undocked from the International Space Station early today. It's scheduled to return to Florida on Friday. The Atlantis delivered tons of spare parts and equipment to the station, and it's bringing home astronaut Nicole Stott. She has completed a 3-month rotation aboard the station. During the mission, Atlantis astronauts also performed 3 spacewalks to help install station equipment. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Medicare open enrollment ends December 31st. More at Medicare.gov or 1-800-MEDICARE.
News from NPR is made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
Hi, I'm Kevin Kelly. Denise and Michael Grupp Verben constitute the folk harp and guitar duo called Tapestry, based in Toledo, Ohio. Their music ranges from Celtic and folk to pop, classical, and more. They will be performing in Bloomington Wednesday night, and they'll be my guests on the Wednesday edition of Live and Local, playing live in our studio. Live and Local is your connection to local music and more, airing weekdays from noon to 1 on FM 90.9.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Freinas at the controls this morning. Once again, in this hour, we'll go to the archives for a show. This program first broadcast in August. So again, keep in mind as you listen, in this hour, we will not be taking your calls. In this hour, Focus 580, we'll be looking back at the life of Henry David Thoreau and looking particularly at one day in Thoreau's life and talk about some events that may just have set the course for his life in some very important ways. The year before he moved to Walden Pond, Thoreau was a man in search of purpose. He was working in the family business, which was pencil making. He had done a lot of other things, but a lot of those things, at least as far as he was concerned, had ended in disappointment. Then one day, and this was in 1844, he was trying to start a campfire, and accidentally he touched off a wildfire that ultimately destroyed 300 acres of woods. It's something that Thoreau scholars have written about, but not very much. Clearly, it was something that made a great impression on him because he wrote about it in his journals later as he wrestled with this event. And our guest, John Pipkin, suggests that it just might have been this thing, this fire, just might have been the thing that really pushed Thoreau into the life that we know about and into the career of being one of America's first modern environmentalists. He writes about this in his novel, his first novel, Woods Burner. It is published by Doubleday. The book's out now, has been getting a lot of very good reviews and has been widely reviewed. Our guest grew up in Baltimore. He's taught writing and literature at St. Louis University, Boston University, and Southwestern University. He currently makes his home in Austin, Texas, and he's joining us this morning by telephone. Mr. Pipkin, hello.
Hello, David. How are you?
I'm fine. And you?
Great. Thanks for having me.
Thanks. Well, we appreciate it. I enjoyed reading the book very much.
Oh, thank you.
And clearly a lot of other people had too. And after I read the book, I waited until after, but after I read the book, went out and started to look at reviews. And I was almost a little bit surprised just at how many reviews of the book I found. And I guess the only thing that I could point to is that it's about Thoreau and that he has a lot of significance to a lot of people, particularly people who are concerned with environmental issues and how people live and what our attitude towards nature is and so forth.
Yes, I think Thoreau has been a real attraction, a real drawing point for the novel. And so I consider myself very fortunate that so many reviewers and people have taken the time to pay attention to the novel. And I'm still a bit overwhelmed that people will actually take the time to sit down and read something that I've written. So it's been a wonderful experience for me.
And it seems that this particular event, it's something that in most accounts of Thoreau's life has merited maybe a single line, and that's about all.
Yes, that's correct. And in fact, as I've been talking to people about the book and going to bookshops, going on book tour, and doing interviews, I feel the need to stress to people that this event is not something that I discovered. This is not the result of years of archival research or anything like that. It's actually a fairly commonly known fact, particularly among Thoreau scholars, that the year before Henry David Thoreau went to Walden Pond, he accidentally started a forest fire that burned down 300 acres of the Concord Woods. And it is mentioned in all of the major Thoreau biographies, but in a biography of, say, 400 pages, it usually takes up maybe a paragraph or a page, and there doesn't seem to be, from what I can find, much speculation given to what long-term effects or influence that this event may have had on his development as a thinker and an environmentalist.
Well, certainly he wrote about it some years later in his journals. What does he himself say about it?
Well, it's very interesting. You know, he had already begun keeping his now famous journals at the time of the fire. He had begun the journals a number of years earlier. And at the time the fire takes place, there are a number of, actually several years of no entries in the journal. And he mentions nothing about the fire at the time that it happens. And it's not until 6 years later that he has a very long and detailed entry in 1850. And it's very, the entry itself is very typical of Thoreau in that you can see him struggling with his own feelings of remorse and guilt, and then also a sort of defensiveness about the fire. And so he begins by saying he felt guilty and shameful for having caused this tragedy. But then at the same time, he began to think that, you know, fire was but a part of nature, and it was just consuming its natural food, and that really what he had done was only destroy private property, and since no man has a right to own the land, he really has nothing to feel guilty for anyway. So you can really see him sort of, you know, sliding back and forth between, on the one hand, feeling guilty for what he has done, but then on the other hand, feeling that no one has any right to blame him for what has happened. So it's a very interesting portrait, I think, of Thoreau's mind.
Yeah, and you use that in the, once we get into the story after the fire starts and he's there, there's this initial, he and a friend make this initial attempt to fight the fire. It very quickly gets away from them. The friend, they're out in a boat. So the friend tries to go back to town by water just as quickly as he possibly can. Mm-hmm. Thoreau decides, well, I'm in this sort of irrational kind of state of mind. He says, well, I'll just run back, which he is not able to do. And at some point when he realizes that he can't get back and deliver the word of the fire, then he's there and he's watching the fire. And you put all of these thoughts, his own thoughts that he later puts down, you put all of those in his head as he's sitting there exhausted from trying to fight the fire and then trying to get back to town to warn people. You put all those thoughts in his head right at that point.
Right. Yes. You know, I really had, I think, sort of the best of both worlds in terms of the documentation and research that was available to me. In that, one of the great challenges of writing historical fiction, particularly when you're dealing with actual historical characters, is how to get inside of a particular character's head, especially someone who is as well known as Henry David Thoreau. How do you get inside their head and portray them in a voice that is, you know, familiar and convincing, but at the same time might introduce some new insights or some new perspective? And the reason why I say I felt like I had the best of both worlds is that Thoreau has written so much in his journals about his intimate thoughts and his own perspectives that it's easier in terms of someone like Thoreau than perhaps some other characters to get a sense of what his personality may have been like, what his language was like, the way he would have phrased thoughts or ideas about a particular situation. And yet at the same time, there is this blank space in his journal on this particular day. So, and from his own accounts 6 years later, he tells us he gives us details of, as you've just described, how he and his friend Edward Sherman Hoare tried to fight the fire, and then Edward took off by boat, and Henry David takes off on foot, and eventually encounters another farmer who goes for help, and Thoreau himself then climbs to the top of Fairhaven Hill and sits there and waits for help to arrive from town. So there was this nice combination in terms of available research of a great deal of detail for what Thoreau is thinking or the way he thinks, and at the same time, these vast blank spaces that were just really sort of a blank canvas on which to be able to interpret what he may have been thinking and saying at the time.
Yeah. Our guest in this hour, Focus 580, John Pipkin. His new novel, his first, is Woods Burner. It's been out now for a little while, and it is about one day in the life of Henry David Thoreau when he, by accident, started a big fire, burned 300 acres of woods, and our guest suggested it just might have been the thing that changed the course of his life in that one day, as it changes the course of the lives of some of the other characters in the book, which we'll talk about. As I said, I certainly enjoyed reading the book. I think one thing I would say that for a little bit at the beginning, I was having a hard time settling into the rhythm of the language. And I wonder to what extent you, in reading Thoreau, were trying to either capture his voice where he's speaking in the book, or whether you were trying to give people something of the feel of language the way people would have written at the time.
Right. It was a little bit of both, actually, trying to certainly portray Thoreau's own thoughts in a language or vocabulary that would have been typical of the language he would have used, and then also in describing the other characters, I wanted to try to approximate what sort of early to mid 19th century American prose would have looked like. But again, there's always, that's another one of the challenges I think of writing historical fiction, is that on the one hand, a writer wants to strive for a certain level of verisimilitude so that you have a real sense of the way people actually spoke and acted and the way that language was used in a particular historical context. But at the same time, it needs to be accessible for a modern reader. So there's always a danger if you are writing about America in the 1840s and you go back and read, you know, novels by Hawthorne and Melville. Sort of the last thing you want to do is to then write a novel that looks like it was written by Hawthorne or Melville, since the modern day reader doesn't, we speak and we read a slightly different language now, and that would become inaccessible to a great number of readers. So I wanted to make sure that the language reflected a kind of style and a kind of vocabulary, but still maintained a modern reader's accessibility. And again, and particularly in the case of Thoreau, because we have such extensive details of the way he described things in his journals, I tried to look at that and then approximate, well, what would have been the kind of vocabulary that he would have used, especially in terms of descriptive language, since Thoreau was very creative and resourceful and even inventive in coming up with words to describe what he saw in the world around him.
Well, I don't want to get too technical, but would you say that what we're talking about here would be sentence structure, sentence length, word choice, all of those things?
I think it's all of those things, certainly. And, it's always tricky in doing something like historical dialogue since, at the end of the day, we really don't know what people sounded like when they spoke, because the only record we have of dialogue is what's written, and that's always going to be, even at the time, sort of an approximation or record of the way people spoke. But, in looking at, novels of the period, letters of the period, journals from that time period, there are certain choices in terms of vocabulary and diction, grammar, sentence structure, that all come into play. And I think that when writing historical fiction, sort of the first rule is kind of a sort of a Hippocratic oath of fiction, which is first do no harm. The first thing you want to do is make sure no one is speaking or using vocabulary or terms that weren't used at the time. And in fact, there were some cases where there were some words that I went to use to describe Thoreau that I thought would have been appropriate to the time, and then when I looked them up, realized that they actually didn't come into use until the 1930s or the 1920s. So to our modern ear, these words sounded historical, but they actually weren't historical enough. So I wanted to make sure that at least on the first part, I wasn't using vocabulary that would have been impossible for anyone at the time period to have used.
Mm, yeah. We have a caller here. Let's bring them into the conversation. Someone in Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Yes. I'm interested in whether the accounts that have been available to you from the time cast light on two questions. The first is how it is that the fire only consumed 300 acres. Did the townspeople put it out, or did it just mostly burn itself out? And second, what sort of attitude did the townspeople have? Did Thoreau's neighbors have toward this event? Were they condemnatory of him, or what?
Oh, sure. Well, on the first point, the reason it only consumed 300 was just as you suggested, that the people of Concord turned out and helped to fight back the flames. The way that the fire spread so rapidly is that at this particular period of time, apparently New England had been suffering from drought, from an unusually dry winter and spring. So there was that element, and then this was also a very windy day, and many people complained at the time that Thoreau should have never even tried to start a campfire on such a day because, he, as an experienced woodsman, should have known that the woods were dry and that it was a very windy day, and you don't light a fire on such a day. So it was this combination of dry woodland and very strong winds that whipped up the flames and forced them northward. And there was for a period of time there was some fear on that day that the fire could have spread all the way north to the town of Concord itself and actually set fire to the town. So when Thoreau goes running for help, he encounters a farmer who agrees to run the rest of the way and sort of rouses the people of Concord, and they turn out and they begin cutting down trees and lighting back fires and essentially, dig a big trench around the woods and stop the advance of the fire that way. One of the other things that also helped to control the spread of the fire was the new rail line that had been built very near Walden Pond from Boston to Vicksburg, and that helped to create sort of a fire break to keep the flames from spreading too far out of control. But it was essentially and mainly the people of Concord who turned out and kept the fire from spreading. And they were quite angry with Thoreau for this for quite some time. The land was mostly privately owned land, that woodland that burned, but it also represented some of the last remaining bits of woodland in Concord at this time. Few people realize that at Walden Pond today there are actually more trees at Walden Pond and in Concord than there were at Thoreau's time, and that's due largely to a reforestation effort in the 20th century. So Concord was already beginning to see the signs of rapid deforestation. The town was growing, agriculture was growing. There were no laws really in place to protect the woods, and even Ralph Waldo Emerson had said, he was thinking of going out and buying some land at Walden Pond just to protect it, to save the trees from the woodsman's axe, I believe was his phrase. So when this private land burned, the people of Concord were very angry at Thoreau, and in fact, by many accounts, they began calling him woods burner behind his back, and some people for the rest of his life referred to him as the woods burner, and that's where the title of the novel comes from. In fact, there would have been a lawsuit filed against Henry David Thoreau, except that his friend Edward Sherman Hoare's father paid the landowners for the loss of the woods.
Ah. Exceptionally interesting stuff. Thank you very much.
Thank you. That was certainly about the detail about the title was something I was going to ask you about. So people actually did say that, did under their breath or muttered it maybe as he walked by, or at least among themselves in talking about him. That would have been the thing that a lot of people would have remembered him for.
That's right. And, you know, at this time, you know, Thoreau's close friends sort of knew him as this very intelligent, sensitive person who was also a very good writer and had a great deal of potential, and they were all trying to pull strings to see if they could, you know, get him a teaching appointment or get him published. But the public at large had no real sense of who Henry David Thoreau was, and so this is sort of his public persona for a while, is the man who sets fire to the Concord Woods, and as as they refer to him as the Woods Burner. And in fact, there is one account that comes from a woman who was a young girl at the time of the fire, and later in the 19th century, someone who's writing an account of Concord in the early part of the century interviews her, and her memory of Thoreau when she was a young girl was that, oh, he's the rascal, he's the woods burner who burned down the Concord Woods, and for months afterwards, all my clothes had soot stains on them, and you couldn't bring firewood into the house without getting your hands all blackened because of all of the soot that was in the air. Yeah. So there was a great deal of ire about what he had done.
You know, clearly, for whatever reason, this is at a point, a very important turning point in Thoreau's life, where he had done a lot of different things, but in a sense wasn't really sure what he wanted to be.
Mm-hmm.
And although I think that you can see the foundations upon which the later Thoreau, the Walden's Pond Thoreau, gets built,
mm-hmm.
But you do have to wonder, well, you know, what did happen? And this is probably as good an explanation as any for what actually pushed him towards something that he seemed to be going toward anyway, but maybe he did indeed need the push.
Right, right. And I wanted to be careful not to make a very rigid, almost academic argument to say, yes, this particular event was the direct cause of Henry David Thoreau going to live at Walden Pond. You know, as you've just pointed out, the main elements of what would become Henry David Thoreau, or his ambitions and his talents, were already in place. He had already spoken to a number of people at this time about wanting to go off somewhere to live in the woods, someplace by himself, not only as an experiment in self-reliance, but also to just have the time to sit and write. He had already taken, at this point in his life, he had already taken his famous trip on the Concord and Merrimack Rivers with his brother John, and had the notes from that trip, but hadn't yet worked them up into the book that would become his first major work. So all of this potential is sitting there, but he can't seem to make the move. He can't seem to find the catalyst that will launch him to do the things that he says he would like to do. And then it seems more than just coincidence, to me at least, that this fire occurs, and then a few weeks later, Ralph Waldo Emerson buys a piece of land at Walden Pond, which is something he's been saying he's been wanting to do to help protect the woodland. And then a few months after that, William Ellery Channing writes to Thoreau and says that, I believe the phrase is, now is the time for you to go and begin the grand process of consuming yourself. And a few months after that, in the following year, Thoreau packs up and moves to Walden Pond and finally begins to take the notes from a week on the Concord and Merrimack River and work them into a book, and, of course, begins writing Walden as well. So it doesn't the fire doesn't really mark a radical shift or departure in his life, but does seem to me to have functioned as a kind of catalyst, or, you know, I hesitate to use the word spark, to finally get him up off the couch and do what he says he's been wanting to do.
Yeah. Well, and it also functions that way for some of the other characters in the book, either pushing them to do something that they were burning to do, so to speak,
right.
Getting them to the point where they abandon something. So for all of them, whether it's either going one direction or going another direction, it was a very dramatic event, and it was the thing that pushed them one way or the other.
Mm-hmm.
Let me just very quickly introduce again our guest, John Pipkin. He's the author of the recently published novel Woods Burner. It's published by Doubleday. It is his first published novel. He's taught writing and literature at a number of places, St. Louis University, Boston University, and Southwestern University. He now makes his home in Austin, Texas. The book's out now in the bookstores, so you might want to look at it. Questions are welcome to 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, I know that you, in talking about the book, have said that you were interested not only in looking at what Thoreau was like at a particular point in his life, at an interesting point in his life, but that you were also interested in looking at America at an interesting point in its history. And I think that the different characters, in some sense, each represent some aspect of America or at that time, or a particular kind of conflict, things that people were wrestling with. Tell me about, you know, America in the middle of the 19th century. What is it that you find interesting about it?
Oh, sure. Well, you know, there were two things that had really made me feel that there was a potential novel in this particular historical detail. And the first is one that we've already covered, which was the state of Thoreau's life at the time. When I began researching this event, I was struck by the extent to which Henry David Thoreau had not yet become the icon Henry David Thoreau, as we know him today, that he was still in this period of development, and in fact had reached a kind of crossroads in his life where so many of his professional endeavors had not really worked out. He was writing but wasn't able to get published. He had tried teaching, but his teaching appointments weren't really working out. He had even tried living in New York for a while, and that hadn't worked out. So Thoreau seemed to be at a crossroads in his life at the very time when this fire takes place. And the second thing that really made me feel that there was a potential for a story here was that America seemed to be at a crossroads, a developmental crossroads, you know, culturally and politically itself. In 1844, the country is still, you know, the idea of the American Revolution is something that is finally beginning to fade sort of on the historical horizon. And at the same time, on the other horizon, the threat of the Civil War is just beginning to rise, but not quite just yet. And so many of the things that we think of when we think of 19th century America hadn't quite happened yet. So if we're thinking in terms of history, you know, the possibility of some kind of conflict between the states is just really becoming an issue, but people aren't really sure yet what direction this is going to go in. The abolitionist movement is just getting started. The Underground Railroad is in existence, but it hasn't really come into its fullest function yet. And even the great literature of the period, I mean, the writers like Hawthorne and Melville, they're writing, but they haven't really produced their major works yet at this time, and so it's no surprise that it's in the 1830s, just a few years before this fire, that Ralph Waldo Emerson gives his American Scholar address, in which he makes his famous call for America to begin to develop its own identity, basically, that, you know, America needs to start its own literature, its own philosophy, its own art, since at this time, Americans are still essentially looking to Europe for its models when it comes to things like fashion or art or literature or philosophy or any kind of intellectual pursuit. So it's really a time for the country when the nation is still looking at itself as a kind of national experiment. We're still wondering what it means to be an American. What is the meaning of the American dream? Why are people coming here? What is the attraction? And where is the country headed? So through the other fictional characters in the story, I was hoping to try to take a look at these various aspects of American culture at this time. Odman Huss is a recent immigrant who has come here again, in pursuit of the American dream, but I was looking at the immigrant experience in America, and Elliot Calvert is struggling with some of those some of the earliest conflicts between art and commerce, and is trying to find his way in the new American business world. And then Caleb Doughty is representative of that sort of evangelical spirit in American thought in the early 19th century.
And it may be that part of the appeal of the book, why so many people resonate with it, is that we are still wrestling with all of those things. Maybe those questions never really go away. It's just from they wax and wane. Well, we're at the time now where all of those things, what it means to be an American, what is the American dream? Can you realize it? How can you realize it? How do we think about newcomers and how people become incorporated into the American life? And then all of these other things like the conflict between art and commerce and different ideas of spirituality. These are all in questions that we're debating very loudly right now.
Oh, yes. It was really astounding the more I looked at the period, how many parallels there are to America in 2009. What's especially astounding to me was the degree to which people in 1844 were already saying things like, America had so much promise, but the American experiment has failed, or somewhere we went wrong. Somewhere in our great, glorious past, we had the chance to really do something wonderful, and we haven't quite pulled it off. Somewhere we went wrong. Somewhere the dream faded or collapsed. That already at this time, there was this sense of loss that I think so often in the modern world we have we hear something similar, sort of similar refrain, that sometime in America's past we were we had it right, we had figured it out, and then we veered off course somehow. And even in Thoreau's time, when he was growing up, America was already suffering from one of its first major recessions. So there was an economic crisis going on as well.
Yeah. I think that the characters, the different characters are all wrestling with these different sorts of conflicts. I think one thing, though, that comes through very strongly in a lot of their lives is the struggle between their desires, various kinds of desires, and that little voice inside you that says, no, you have to keep your desires in check.
Mm-hmm.
So I think fire is a nice metaphor for runaway desires. I'm sure it's a metaphor for a lot of different sorts of things. Is that something particularly sort of conflict between what you want and what you think you should have? Is that something that particularly interests you?
It does. I'm interested in that as I guess you'd say as a universal theme, certainly, and particularly as an American theme, since both politically and culturally, America is founded on this idea of freedom, and the sort of unquestioned universal appeal of absolute freedom, and yet people so often create their own internal restrictions or their own internal prohibitions to the things that they would actually like to do. That real freedom is a very daunting thing. And brings with it a great deal of responsibility. And so for many of these characters, especially for the characters who are newly arrived on America's shores, here's the promise of freedom. They're escaping the oppression of the old world. And then once they get here, it's actually quite terrifying, the idea that, not only are you free to do whatever you want, but you also bear the full responsibility for what your choices are. And for many people, I think that particular burden is crippling, and so they keep their desires in check, because to have to bear the burden of absolute responsibility for all your choices is just too much.
Mm-hmm. I think if this book belongs to anyone beside Thoreau, I think the other character that it really belongs to is this young man, Odmund Huss, this fellow who comes from Norway with his family as a boy, and there's a terrible accident, and he's orphaned. So he's here all by himself. He doesn't speak English, has to make his way. So it's kind of an iconic sort of immigrant story.
Mm-hmm.
And at the point where the townspeople are all fighting the fire, he really comes to the attention of Thoreau, and something about him interests Thoreau. This man, Edmund, actually has lived in a little house in the woods by himself, the thing that Thoreau goes on to do. Tell us more about Edmund Huss and what about that character you like, and where does that come from?
Well, he really does begin to emerge in the book as the major character. To a certain extent, Thoreau, after setting the story in motion at the beginning, I think really fades into the background and becomes not really a minor character, but certainly on par with the other four major characters. And Edmund really does come to the fore as one of the main, if not the main character of the book. And I really, through Edmund, wanted to create a character who was very much on the fringes of society, very much an outsider, which, you know, for America in the 1840s, it's even more so than today a nation of immigrants. Everyone who is making up the established society, the established country, has come from somewhere else, has come from another country. And you know, one sort of startling detail I'd come upon was that already at this time in America's history, you could begin to see the difference between people who had come one or two generations earlier and people who had recently arrived, because Americans were already growing larger, because there was, you know, just the available resources and the nutrition and the food that was available. People were already marked by their height and their size compared to the newly arrived. So it was a country in which, you know, to be someone in Edmund's position, to be a newly arrived immigrant, he's already sort of on the fringes of this society. And I had him coming from Norway, really, because I wanted him to be coming from a country where he didn't have a lot of fellow countrymen here. Mm-hmm. He was that much more ostracized from everyone. And really, given Thoreau's philosophy, I wanted Edmund to embody that sense of a man leading a life of quiet desperation. That he thinks he knows what he wants. He believes he's fallen in love with someone, but everything seems beyond his grasp. Everything seems sort of, you know, beyond what he's actually capable of going out and doing. And he's also terrified of his own desires and of bearing the responsibility of what could happen were he to act on his own desires. And so that leaves him in this state of just sort of self-isolation until something like the fire forces him to deal with other people and sort of forces him into the society.
Yeah. I think that probably a lot of people know that line, that most men lead lives of quiet desperation. I wonder actually how many people know that's Thoreau.
Oh, yes, right. And you know, one of the things I struggle with the book is that Thoreau had not yet written that line at this time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's of course from the opening pages of Walden. And so I wanted to find a way of bringing that idea into the story in a way to show that what Thoreau is writing about just a year or two later is something that is already current in the society and is sort of permeating the people in America, even though Thoreau himself has not yet penned the line.
And I suppose, I guess I didn't think about it until right this moment, but I suppose that would be a good way of describing all of the characters in the book. They really are each in his or her own way. They are leading lives of quiet desperation in the sense that they feel unsatisfied, incomplete. There's something they want to do, but they're not quite sure how to get there. They're perhaps questioning some things that are really fundamental, so that they're all really in that place right at this point.
Yes, exactly. Whether they're whether their ambitions are to be artists or business people, or whether it's just a simple ambition like running a farm, raising a family, or even in the case of Caleb Doughty, where he's sort of waiting for a second or a third great awakening, that everyone has this desperate feeling that they're keeping to themselves, that they're not acting upon because they're not sure how their actions would be perceived by others. They're not sure how their actions would fit into the culture at large.
Yeah. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is John Pipkin. We're talking about his new novel, Woods Burner, and it's a good story. I would suggest people go look at it. It's published by Doubleday. It's been out here for just a little while. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. One of the characters in the book here, Elliot Calvert, is a man who runs a bookstore. And happens to be in Concord at this particular day because he has this idea that he's going to open up a branch or open up another business there. And here is a man who, he runs this bookstore and he has a family that he has to support, but he really, really, really wants to be a playwright. And from the little bits of his thinking about this and his writing that we get in the book, clearly you get the idea that this man, he should not quit his day job because he is never going to, you know, he's never going to be a playwright. And yet this is something that he desperately wants, and he struggles with that and struggles to find time to write, struggles to, you know, over what are the right words and what story should I be telling? Did you pour a lot of your frustration as a writer into this poor man?
I think I probably did. I guess there's probably no way for me to answer that question by saying no. that was purely a fictional creation. I've always been interested in the sort of reverse narratives that we construct for people who have achieved some level of success, especially, you know, artistic success. Whereas if you look at someone who, you know, for 10 or 20 or 30 years struggles toward a goal and then eventually accomplishes that goal, we look at that life narrative and say, well, here is someone who never gave up on their dreams. Here is someone who, through determination, finally achieved their goal. Whereas if we take that same narrative and turn it on its head and think of someone who spends 10 or 20 or 30 years, you know, trying to cut an album with their rock band, let's say, and they fail and they don't achieve that, the narrative we tend to hear is, well, there's someone who really lost touch with reality, or there's someone who, you know, was so hard-headed and so stubborn that they couldn't tell when they should just hang it up and go get a day job. So it's interesting that those same impulses, those same ambitions get judged very differently depending upon how the story plays itself out. And so through Elliot, I was sort of looking at someone who, as you pointed out, probably really doesn't have, unfortunately, much talent as a playwright, but isn't sure when do you stop, when do you give that up, when do you just say, okay, I need to just stop pursuing this dream and focus on my day job. And at the same time, he's also someone who really isn't terribly honest with himself. He likes to think of himself as someone who is, above the, you know, material concerns and desires of his age, but really, really enjoys the sort of material benefits that he gets from the businesses that he started.
Yeah. He, just in brief, and I've got a call I will get to, but he's been laboring long over this play that involves a house burning down.
Yeah.
And when he realizes there's this fire, then he thinks, oh, this is actually a great opportunity for me to actually directly experience this thing that I'm trying to write about. So then when I go to write, I'll be better able to describe it. And then when confronted with this real, with the dramatic reality of this wildfire, that seems to be the thing that finally says to him, what are you doing?
Yeah.
What are you doing here? And he sort of drops his shovel and turns around and goes home and essentially gives it up.
Right. Yeah, and you know, it's also been kind of amazing how many people have asked me since the book, you know, if I have ever started a fire or ever fought a fire myself.
Really?
And I never have. I mean, aside from lighting the grill in our backyard, that's about the extent of my knowledge and expertise in dealing with fire. But there is this sense in general that you know, artists and anyone who is writing about anything, that you're dealing from personal experience, that art and personal experience go hand in hand, and that you never really just make things up. And especially for someone like Elliot in this particular case, when he tries to go out and have this, you know, hands-on experience about an event that he wants to write about, it's too much for him. It's just overpowering.
Yeah. Let's talk with someone here. Champaign County, line number one. Hello.
Hi. I was trying not to call, but I guess I'm going to be noisily desperate here or something. I wonder whether you tried to portray kind of another thing that one can compare to this time, which is the really draconian religious fundamentalism under the Great Awakening. I know many people cast it as an opening, but it seems to me that if you were looking at it from the point of view of maybe, say, the Transcendentalists or something, who were quite such free spirits and that sort of thing, do you try to cover that in any kind of subplot or anything?
I do some through the character of Caleb Doughty. Some of the things I was trying to get at was this, as I was saying earlier, this contradiction in America between being the land of freedom and at the same time having a kind of, as you've called it, draconian sort of spirituality that runs through it that seeks to put limits on people's actions and to say, you know, to spell out exactly what is forbidden and what you cannot do and to create a very narrow path of acceptable behavior within the context of a country that defines itself as being the land of freedom, where people can come to escape those very kinds of restrictions. And in a more, even more sort of specific way, I was trying to take a look at sort of, you know, intersections between a kind of root evangelical approach toward the natural world in America and how it is that, you know, we can see a country with so much, you know, natural abundance that at the same time is exploited, when you would think that perhaps a country with this kind of evangelical streak would want to protect that world as part of a larger creation. So I was sort of trying to look at those contradictions between, you know, freedom and prohibition and naturalism and exploitation, and take a look at, you know, how did these forces come together and intersect at this particular time.
Would you have a for instance of how you tried to illustrate, or is that just too hard to?
Well, I guess one for instance would be Caleb Doughty's perspective on the Transcendentalists. The fact that so many of the Transcendentalists are looking to nature as a way of accessing the spiritual world as somehow representative of spirituality, and for Caleb, the natural world is actually a distraction from scripture, a distraction from his own dogmatic beliefs.
I was thinking more in terms of some kind of interaction that would show the as I called it, draconian. I mean, there was even a surgical solution at that time for people who were what I guess might be called chronically oversexed or something like that. And I just wondered whether you tried to visit that. It sounds pretty difficult. So thanks a lot.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I didn't quite look at that particular intersection. But I think there are some. I don't want to give away anything that happens toward the later parts of the book. But I think there are some encounters between Doughty and some of the other characters that try to shed a little bit of light onto. Say different sexual beliefs or different approaches to sexuality at the time.
He's an interesting character. He's a very sort of traditional fire and brimstone kind of preacher who takes over his father's church when his father has a stroke, and he's so intent on having his parishioners feel the flames that he has a wood stove put into the church and has it stoked to the max while he is preaching. to make it so hot in the church that the prisoners don't know this.
Right, it's a very literal approach.
Yeah, it makes a very literal approach because he wants them to feel the flames as he's standing there in the pulpit and talking about it. And yet he's someone who himself, he goes off, he's looking for a sign. I think he's wanting God to appear and say, yes, my son, you've got it all right. And near the end, he goes marching into the fire. And one wonders exactly what it is that he's looking for in trying to come face to face with the fire. Kind of like he's, I don't know if he's marching into hell at that point or what.
Right. Well, he's someone who very much desires a literal, tangible, empirical proof for matters of faith that on the one hand he might be the first to say, well, these are matters of faith and you can't find physical proof, but at the same time, you know, desperately desires some kind of physical proof and you know, to a certain extent would rather embrace something like fiery damnation if that would at least provide him with some kind of tangible proof of the existence of something beyond this world.
Yeah. I think it's just to finish, and we have maybe about a minute or so, I guess I was really struck by something I heard you say in an interview where you said you really thought that, you know, in so many ways, people in the past, you know, they're really not that different than we are. Maybe they would have expressed themselves somewhat differently, but the things they were really consumed with and concerned about are the same.
Yes. Well, in envisioning these characters, I tried to think of them as human beings whose essential desires and fears have not changed. You know, the fear of their own mortality, desire for companionship, sexual desire, personal, professional ambitions. These things seem, to me at least, to have not changed in human history, but the context in which they occur, and the limitations and freedoms in which that were available to people at various times in history have, of course, radically changed from period to period and country to country. And so the way that these fears and ambitions and desires get expressed, or even can be acted out, are very different in every period. But essentially, at root, those human tendencies, I think, have remained the same.
Yeah. The book is Woodsburner by our guest John Pipkin. It's published by Nantalese Doubleday. John Pipkin has taught writing and literature at a number of places at St. Louis University, Boston University, and Southwestern University. He lives in Austin. And thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, David, thanks so much. I've really enjoyed this.
And you've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives, a show that was first broadcast on August 17th. Many past shows from Focus 580, the afternoon magazine, a lot of our local production is available on our website. And if you haven't looked at it, you might go there. It's will.illinois.edu. Support for today's broadcast comes from Community Blood Services of Illinois, providing all donated blood for patients in Champaign-Urbana, Charleston, Mattoon, Danville, and Effingham. There are no substitutes for donated blood. Blood donation takes 45 minutes and saves lives. Information at 367-2202 or on the web at bloodservices.org. We are WILL, and WILL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois. That's it for us on Focus 580, but we want you to stay tuned. More coming up as part of the afternoon magazine. The host of the show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you very much, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, some special programming. We'll have for you the 3rd annual Eastern Illinois Food Bank Hunger Symposium. Again, that's coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the afternoon magazine. In Kansas City, December wheat is trading at 547.5, up 18. March, 564, up 18.25. In Chicago, December wheat, 549, up 16. March, 570.25. Make that 570 even, up 16.5. December corn, 390.5, up 14.5. March, 406.5, up 14.5. May, 416.75, up 14.75. July, 425.25, up 14.75. January soybeans, 1047.5. 1.5, up 1.5. March, 10.53.5, up 1.5. May, 10.56.75, up 2.5. July, 10.60.75, up 2.25. December soybean meal, 3.18.30, that's up 2.90. December oil, 40.16, up 46. December live cattle, 83.67.5, up 27.5. February, 85.77.5, up 27.5. January feeder cattle, 92.90, down 32.5. March, 94.20, down a nickel. December lean hogs, 59.45, that is up 82.5. January crude, 76.87, up 85. The U.S. dollar, 74.52, down 54. The CRB index, 276.87, up 4.61. The Dow is up 19, the NASDAQ up 5, and the S&P 500 up 3. It's noon. This is